Hi, it's Beth again, one of the journalists at Manx Radio. Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Newscast. I don't say this lightly, but we very often here speak to people who are particularly inspiring or especially courageous. And honestly, those words don't go anywhere near enough for describing the guest of today's newscast. Sarah Jarvis was diagnosed with ovarian cancer last year, and we're talking to her because March is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. We talked on Manx Radio last week about the signs and symptoms from a clinical point of view of this disease, but Sarah has been through it firsthand and really wants to use her experience to reach out to others. Let's hear from Sarah now.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jarvis, 58, if you need to know that, currently having treatment for ovarian cancer.
And we're talking, Sarah, because March is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month.
That's
and
correct.
There was something very poignant just before we started recording that you said about this being a silent one. What did you mean by that?
If anybody's actually also managed to see what Kat, the Macmillan nurse who you talked to last week, if anybody's managed to read that, she will also have called it that. It presents with very vague symptoms, and personally, I barely had any of those symptoms at all, so it was even more silent. It was always, a woman tends only to go to the doctor when the symptoms are really, really noticeable, and by then it's usually advanced. So the earlier you can get this, the better it is. Otherwise, I say it's got quite silent symptoms, which some GPs, I was very lucky with mine, some GPs are want to dismiss as something like IBS or menopause or whatever. So yeah, that's why it's known as the silent one.
So what was it then, Sarah, that meant that you thought, oh, I need to go and see a doctor about something?
Well, 2023 was the year that just gave and gave, and I'd been made redundant in the start of March, really. And because of that, and at that point I'd been travelling a lot for work, very, very busy job, I had a bit of low-grade abdominal pain. That's how I would describe it. Not to be too graphic, but sort of a bit like period pain, but due to my age, I knew it definitely wasn't that, plus the fact I'd had a hysterectomy, a subtotal hysterectomy, as in they'd left the ovaries, when I was about 36, so I knew it wasn't period pain. And that, there are ladies who will understand this, that sort of low-grade grumbling and a little bit in my back. And that had been going on for a while, and I had just been ignoring it because I was so busy. With a slight gift in its hands that redundancy break brought, I was at home more and I could concentrate on myself a little bit more, so I made an appointment with the doctor. And it kind of went from there.
And what process did you have to go through to get through that diagnosis stage?
So, as I previously mentioned, extremely fortunate with my GP at Palatine, Dr. Rafiq, and I will sing her praises because she was absolutely amazing for me. She listened, she looked me in the eye, she didn't dismiss me. I should interject at this point that my paternal grandmother had died of ovarian cancer, which of course is a trigger for a GP to listen to that. It just so happens that I have not inherited that from her, but that's a different story. So she listened, she did a bit of some investigation, but basically wrote me up for some blood tests and for an ultrasound. And she did that ultrasound urgently, which is extremely helpful because I wasn't floundering in the bottom of a waiting list. And the principal blood test for that was something called CA125, that's cancer antigen 125, which is a biomarker, it's a tumour biomarker. It can be elevated for other reasons, so pregnancy, definitely not, had a hysterectomy. Menstruation, definitely not, had a hysterectomy. Endometriosis, possible, or cancer. So if you get an elevated CA125 reading, that triggers an ultrasound. So that was my next part. So from the ultrasound, I went to an MRI, which anybody who's had one of those, they know they're a particular joy. Not painful or anything, but just really peculiar, very noisy things. And then I got a fairly urgent phone call to say, could I please also have a CT scan? And was referred to Mr. Stock, who is the onco-gynae at Nobles, and off we went, basically, and got the news in probably in the middle of May. So from the end of March, when I first went to the GP, to probably having a hint that there was something wrong in April and a definite diagnosis in the middle of May, just before we were going to Rome to see Bruce Springsteen. So that was nice.
What do you remember about that time?
Now, I know they always say take someone with you, and they say you don't take it in, but I did, strangely.
Did you know? Do you think you knew?
I think I probably knew, because I knew it wasn't the two other things it could have been. So I'd gone away on holiday with my sister briefly at the start of May, and I was having some pains, and the weird thing is, I kept thinking, well, I'm not getting any thinner. And anybody who knows me, I'm sort of, you know, quite well upholstered. And I certainly wasn't losing any weight. And you think, well, how can it be cancer? You know, like you've got this image in your head of people feeling very ill and being very slim and skinny and, you know, like losing weight uncontrollably and stuff. And that wasn't the case. I suppose you know on some levels, and you dread it on some levels, I suppose. But it is that, as again, anybody else who's ever been in that chair and received that news. I was quite calm. And I think this has been important to me ever since, is my relationship with that medical team, or all the medical teams now that I have been involved with across a number of different hospitals. That becomes very important. And I was going to talk a little bit about the need for self-advocacy. I suppose you really, really need to understand what they're saying to you. That's really important to me, that I can speak to them, not as an equal, of course it isn't, because they know far more than I do, but it became very important to me to read up about it, to understand the language that they were using. That helps personally for me. The more I know, the calmer that keeps me and the better I feel about it. I know there are some women, and indeed other people with cancer, who are, I just don't want to know, don't tell me, I don't want to Google it. Google's an interesting friend, as we all know. But it was really important to me that I understood as much as I could, and I could speak with the doctors on a level that suited me, and they've been really good like that. The worst thing for me was if somebody were to patronise me or condescend me about this stuff, that would be just dreadful for me. I couldn't stand it.
I just want to go back to something you said. You talked about your paternal grandmother, mm-hmm. who died of ovarian cancer. We know from speaking to Kat that there can be a genetic tendency, but you said you didn't inherit that from her.
No, so as part of your diagnostic process, they do a blood test to check for what they call as BRCA. That's the way we pronounce BRCA, BRCA, which is breast cancer gene. And that BRCA1 and BRCA2, if you carry that faulty gene, and you may have inherited that from one parent or the other, can mean you have a propensity to ovarian cancer. So it's very important that they check for that. The nerves, I suppose, around that when they test for that is for me personally, and to think, does that mean I'm also going to get breast cancer? Am I also going to have to, you know, surgery for mastectomy and all the rest of it? It's just, you know, that goes off in your head. But worse than that, because you'd put up with anything if it was just you, worse than that is the implication for my children, and not just my daughters, because obviously men get breast cancer too. So that's an important thing for people to bear in mind. But that BRCA gene, that faulty BRCA gene, can be implicated in prostate cancer and I believe pancreatic, but shoot me if I've got that wrong. So it's waiting for that result is quite interesting. Has an implication, obviously, for my siblings and for their children. You know, if it's a sort of strongly inherited thing and it's come through that paternal line, then that would have been interesting. As it happens, I am not BRCA positive. So that was great news on that, from that point. So what I've got is not inherited. It's come from somewhere. It's got to start somewhere, as these things sometimes do. I do have a genetic twist, I suppose, but it's the way my tumours behave. It's a thing called HRD, homologous recombination deficiency. And that just means, in the midst of all of that, what you would call bad luck, and I try not to wallow in it, but what you would call bad luck, in the midst of all that, it meant that my tumours responded very well to chemotherapy. So there was a little glimmer in the middle of all that. And then being HRD positive, as I am, that also informs the kind of maintenance treatment that I am, have just started that journey. So I've finished chemo and I've started that journey.
But if we go back to May then, you receive the diagnosis. What process did you go through at that point?
It's not like anything I've ever felt before. I've had ups and downs in my life. I've lost people, had bad news like being made redundant, you know, just the things that you go through with your kids and losses of parents and all of that sort of stuff. This is nothing like I've ever felt before. I've likened it to saying you open a door that you didn't really know existed, a shadowy door, and you walk through it and that door shuts behind you. And nothing is ever the same again. It's going to make me a bit emotional while I talk about it. It's life's very different. Hard not to be scared. But you still got to have hope. And there's a lot of love around me. Sorry, very emotional. I'm very, very blessed by the love I've got around me. And I can't imagine how some people must have to go through this on their own without a partner, without a family. I've been blessed in that respect and really blessed with amazing friends and support, and support that's come from places I wouldn't even have imagined. Apologies. Sorry. It is an emotional thing. So you can see, even after all these months, it still kind of gets you. And in some ways, actually, it's more emotional now than it was at the time, because I think you're just in shock. And you've just got to get through it with every bit more diagnostics. Or, you know, there was a particularly unpleasant biopsy procedure that was done while I was awake by MRI for about 50 minutes, lying on my front, completely still, couldn't move. Again, the consultant radiologist up there was absolutely amazing. And he was like, I've probably done 120 of these, but I've never done one this hard. And he said, but I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't think I could. So you have to trust, the trust that you have to put in these people who are all doing their best for you. And I think that's something that's really struck me, is what a partnership this is. You for me, really important, I say, understanding the thing, having the language for the stuff, having that relationship with the staff. It's that tiny bit of control that you can have, because otherwise you're absolutely at the mercy of processes and medicine and other people. And I think if you are open to them and you understand what it is they're trying to achieve, I think that helps your outcome. And again, I'm blessed. I can't imagine what it must be like if you didn't have English as a first language, for instance, or you were naturally not inclined to self-advocate like I am. I think that would be a very different outcome. I think if you just accepted every letter as it came and did what it was told. I mean, you know, I can't speak highly enough of the teams I've had, but there are glitches in admin, shall we say. And I think even they would admit that. And I think if you're not self-advocating, you can't call that stuff out. You can't catch that stuff. And I think I'm very lucky, the kind of personality I am, I suppose, you know, that's helped me to stay on top of that sort of stuff. You know, then you get an appointment letter and it's actually for something where it should have come after the scan, or just things like that you can point out. And the team, Kat and her colleagues, Jackie as well, and Mr. Stock and all of that team, are fantastic for helping you fix those kinds of things.
You mentioned that because of your genetics, your tumours responded well to chemotherapy.
Yep.
How did you cope with all of that? Because the after effects...
It's foul. It's foul. I mean, I can't lie. It's foul. And anybody else who's ever been through it will know that it's foul. There's a sort of gold standard set of drugs, I suppose, they give you. It's all a bit suck it and see. I mean, all of these things, because they don't know how you are going to respond and how you're going to feel on it. So I started on two different drugs. One is called carboplatin, which is the big gun. It's a platinum-based chemotherapy, and that is the thing that my genetics has responded very well to. The other drug that they started me on was one called paclitaxel, and I had a terrible time on it. That was my first one, an absolutely terrible time on it. And even the steroids and the antiemetics and all the stuff that they give you, I it was really, really grim. Terrible, terrible joint pain. Mental health through the floor, but that can be some of the additional drugs that they give you. You know, they can have a real effect on you brain-wise. So I had one dose of paclitaxel, and I had to go in and see them and say, I can't do this. You know, those bits in the small of the night where you just think, I can't do this. I'd rather it took its course than do this, you know. And anybody who's gone through this journey will understand those thoughts. One dose of paclitaxel was enough to make my hair fall out. One dose. It's that toxic that one dose is enough. And out it came 2 weeks later. Oh, yeah, that is pretty, pretty, pretty low. And, you know, there may be people listening who just say, well, it's just hair and it'll grow back. And, you know, but, you know, I was blonde and, you know, took good care of my hair and spent a lot of money on it and all that stuff. And, you know, and you know, as you can see, because you're sitting beside me, it's growing back grey and curly. And that's really weird to go from being a sort of, you know, blonde to looking like my mother in the mirror, you know. So there's quite a lot of, you have to get, part of that journey is that sense of self, like, you know, how you look, but that door, as I said, you've walked through and you can't go back again. You know, everything is different. And I did buy a wig, and I didn't wear the wig because on the rare occasions I went out, because you have to really watch your immunity, obviously, when you're on chemo, on the rare occasions I did go out, I actually wore like headscarves, because then I looked like a chemo patient. Whereas if I went out in a wig, I looked like a chemo patient wearing a wig. And there is a difference. And it just, you know, I absolutely, you know, respect anybody and the choices they make in there, but it wasn't quite for me. So I sort of fronted it out, really. And bit by bit, the hair came back. But the chemo is vile. And it's not just, oh, it makes you feel a bit poo for a week. You only really pick up in the third week. Because then I say you have to stay away from people because of your low immunity. And then things like you're really, really breathless because it kills off your red blood cells. Therefore, your hemoglobin is affected. Therefore, just even walking upstairs, you're like a wheezing heap of tiredness. And there's just sometimes all you can do is just curl up in a ball, you know. And then you think, well, I'm not living. You know, you're not living life. But this is the only way that you can get to a point where you can start to live life again. So it's got to be, you know, got to be endured, really.
Have you ever had that why me thought?
Do you know, not really. Because why not me? If it's going to happen to one in two, if one in two people is going to get cancer, why not me? I've read a very, very, very interesting book by a physician called Dr. Gabor Maté. And the book is called When the Body Says No. And somebody had said to me they weren't particularly surprised that I ended up getting cancer, that there's almost a cancer personality. And I've always been a people pleaser and, you know, I'm not very good with boundaries and saying no and all that sort of stuff. And it's quite, quite interesting. On other diseases as well. Fascinating book. You don't have to believe it, but it's, you know, because I think the medical profession, because they are consultants and they're specialists, they deal very much with, well, this is your area, you know, this is the area of your body that we're going to take care of and we're going to give you treatment for that. Gabor Maté is very of the holistic thing, you know, your body and everything is a machine, all those systems are interleaved, and if you're living a very stressful life and you are running on cortisol and you're not getting enough rest and you are not very good with your boundaries and those kinds of things are not good for you. So this is not just as simple as smoking and lung cancer, for instance, you know, but there are people who've never smoked who get lung cancer. You know, it's not, you know, if cancer was all about lifestyle, for instance, well, why do babies get it? You know, why do children get it? So, you know, there's a lot of opinion out there, you know, and so, oh, well, you know, yes, she's, as I've said, a bit well upholstered, you know, maybe it's my fault for being overweight, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. It's none of those things. It's just a lottery. So in terms of why me, why not me?
Where are things up to now, Sarah? Where are you on your journey?
So, finished chemo in January. I had six lots of chemo, but I actually had four, and then I had surgery. And at first, they weren't sure whether they could even do the surgery because I am stage three. And so stage three and stage four are known as basically advanced stages. And stage three basically meant that it has spread from my either fallopian tubes and ovaries to my lymph nodes, hence the extreme biopsy, which was quite grim, in through my back. So it spread to my para-aortic lymph nodes, and they, apparently there was a little patch of it on my bowel, and it just grows into other places. So there's a layer, a sort of fatty layer, not just fatty because I'm well, but Holston, that's everybody, the omentum, which runs across your sort of abdomen, and various other structures, I suppose, where the ovarian cancer can grow away from the ovaries. Stage four is actually when it's metastasized, really, you know, when it's become, it's gone beyond the abdominal cavity into other places. So I'm stage three when I was diagnosed. Because I had responded well to the chemo, they decided that I could indeed have surgery. So I should say, as well as Nobles and the good team at Nobles, I have an oncologist who's based in Clatterbridge. I've never actually met her in person. We can do everything online, which is fantastic. All my Zoom calls are, you know, with Clatterbridge. Don't have to travel. And the same with chemo. That's all been done on the island. But they referred me to a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous surgeon called Sian Taylor, Miss Taylor, at Liverpool Women's. And I went there in November to have the surgery. And that's another story. Coming home when you've had major abdominal surgery on a boat or a plane. I came by boat in the end. That was interesting. As you can imagine, every bump and every roundabout and every speed bump in Liverpool and everything trying to get to the boat. So yeah, that was pretty grim. Thank God for my husband. I think it's called adjuvant surgery, basically. So you have some chemo, you have some surgery, you have some more chemo to mop up anything that they might have disturbed, I suppose. And my surgeon, Miss Taylor, had said, she bore out the fact that I had responded very well to the chemo. So she said, kind of when she went in, she could see the scars of where it used to be, which is fantastic. So she ended up taking out less than she had feared she would. They were going to take my spleen. They were going to do the full removal of the omentum, the ovaries, fallopian tubes, bowel resection I was supposed to be having. You know, it's absolutely huge, the surgery. So if the Princess of Wales is going through any of this kind of stuff, let me just tell you, no wonder she's not being seen until Easter. It's pretty huge. The surgery is enormous, and they actually cut you from, I'm just gesticulating towards my chest bone, from, you know, it's a vertical cut, not a horizontal cut. So it's huge. You're basically unzipped and then they zip you back up again. So that's massive. So I was in HGU for a couple of days, and then back on the ward in Liverpool Women's for five more days, I think, and then made that very painful journey home. It's pretty grim.
And you mentioned now you're on maintenance drugs. What does that mean?
So maintenance, really, again, if you can call it lucky, I'm lucky that it's this point in these drugs development, because some of them are so new. I mean, they've really been only available for a couple of years. And I think I remember Mr. Stock saying this to me, if it were 4 or 5 years ago, you wouldn't have had these options. I'm on two drugs now, one called Avastin and one called Olaparib. They work in very different ways. One cuts the blood supply effectively off to the tumours, and the other one works on that genetic makeup that I've talked about. The Olaparib does that. And they're keeping a watching brief, I think, is what we can say. So I had a scan about a month ago, which is post-op and post-chemo. So I thought, it'll be brilliant. There'll be nothing there. And my consultant was, your scan, you know, which is not what you want to hear. So there's a couple of funny little things going on in there with lymph nodes and stuff. So she, again, as you know, a testament to the care I'm getting, she is going to I'm going to have a CT scan every 3 months so she can watch what's happening with that. And I've just got to do my best. I've got to, you know, and the drugs don't make you feel great. I mean, lots of nausea, you know, from the maintenance drugs. I didn't get out of my pajamas yesterday, let's put it that way, you know. And then other times you just think, oh, come on, you know, put some makeup on, put some clothes on, get out there. You know, doing something like this is fabulous because it gets me up and out, which is good. And I'd be passionate now about spreading the word, you know. So I say if doing something like this stops one woman from going through what I'm going through, then it will be worth it.
So if you're talking to that one woman, mm-hmm. who might be half listening to the radio at the moment and thinking, I don't know, should I get checked out? What would be your overriding message, Sarah?
It's hard because I say, you know, because the symptoms are so non-specific, and I'm sure when you put this piece up, you can put one of their posts up that tells you about the symptoms, about bloating and about getting full very quickly and about maybe needing to pee more often. Apparently, as a result of some of the stuff I've put on social media, there are quite a few doctor surgeries who've had quite a few phone calls, and that is just fine. Because say if 30 women made that phone call, two of them had some strange things and only one of them got found, well, that one of them will have been worth it. I think don't let, and I'm not being rude about GPs because they're very busy, but I say do not let a GP fob you off, I think would be my advice as well. An awful lot of women get dismissed as having IBS, say, but IBS doesn't usually present in people, or certainly doesn't start in people over 50. So if you're over 50, don't let them tell you it's that necessarily. It might be, but it might not be. Get the tests. Don't let them just tell you it's menopause. Don't let them tell you all of that stuff. Suggest, could you please test me? Could I please have the blood test? Because I think the blood test is cheap, you know, it's not like very expensive diagnostics. In and of itself, it's not a 100% accurate, you know, either whether it's low or high, it's not necessarily that accurate, but it is an indicator. That's all they can do. It's a rule of thumb. If that number is high, they will send you for more diagnostics. But don't put up with it. Do be brave, do go to a doctor, and do insist if you feel you're being fobbed off, gently push back at them. And I think that's really important. I didn't have to push back. I was very lucky, but there are an awful lot of women who do and who are dismissed.
The other important message, I think, Sarah, which would be great to highlight, is there is life after diagnosis.
Absolutely. Yes. And we'll say it's a bucket list because that's the neatest way of putting it. But so obviously I'm now not working, but my husband is still working. And we decided we would do things like pay off the mortgage. You know, we just took a bit of a hit, but did that. And then took a look at our finances and decided, well, we may as well spend it and go and have some fun. So I've got a very big birthday next year. I'll be 60 next year. And my bucket list for that was going to be a safari. So we're going to do it this year instead. So we're just bringing some of those bucket list things forward. So we're just about to book the Maldives as well, because we've always wanted to go there, that do that water villa thing. The safari in October is going to be amazing. We're going to Kenya. And this weekend this was going to be my properly end of chemo treat. So this weekend we're going to see Simple Minds on Saturday night, gives my age away as well, and then Echo and the Bunnymen in Liverpool. That's like a homecoming gig. So we've always loved our gigs and our music, so we're going to go and do a bit of that and a bit of traveling, spend the children's inheritance, which they're delighted for us to do. That's absolutely great. And plan some stuff. You know, there's always that fear, you know, always like, should we be booking that, you know, because it's a year and a bit in advance. Well, you've just got to do it. If I get a couple more years, then we'll have done it. If I get 10 more years, then we'll have done it. So actually, what's not to do?
And you mentioned your husband and your children. How have they coped over what has been a really turbulent, it's only sort of 10 months or so, really?
Yeah, it's really hard for them. If I start at the bottom and work up, so my son Tom is actually living in Indonesia at the moment, so he hasn't really been around, but he's kept in touch, which is great, but he hasn't had to sort of sit and watch me go through this. My daughters, Ellen and Rachel, Ellen lives in Jersey, so I don't see her a great deal. She's got a very busy job. She's a lawyer, but she sort of dropped everything and came up at one point, which is, you know, fantastic. Rachel, who lives in the UK, she's in Birmingham, but she dropped everything and came as well. So I'm you know, very lucky. And it's hard because as a mum, I want to protect them from stuff. You know, I mean, they may be in their late 20s, but I still want to protect them from stuff. You know, that's your job as your mum. And I haven't been able to do that. I've had to be very vulnerable, I suppose, with them and let them give me their strength, which they have. And all the love, as I say, and lovely gifts and just their presence when I feel like crap, basically, has just been, you know, elevating. Hard for Andrew. I'm a talker, as you can tell. Andrew, not so much. So that's hard. I mean, that's what makes us a, you know, really good team. We'll have been married 40 years next year, you know, and this is that whole in sickness and in health thing. You know, it's really hard. He's also a solutions man. So, you know, this has been really tough for him because there are no solutions. You know, all he can do is bring me tea and bring me toast and when I feel like poo and, you know, just take care of me and feed me when I can't feed myself, you know, and I don't mean physically, I mean make the dinner. He's, you know, massively kept the home fires burning when I've been rolled up in a ball, you know, which is just fantastic. We've got two very hairy golden retrievers as well who, you know, also you have to get up and see them sometimes, you know, that's family life does just carry on, you know. So I say you've all walk through this door into this other room, but life does still go on. It has to. And it does give you, probably I'm slightly less tolerant of crap than I used to be. And some of the nonsense that people do and say and come out with, and you just think that's just not important. It's just not important. But yeah, love is everything, you know. And I so certainly when I came out of hospital, you know, my girlfriends kind of set to, and they did a bit of a rota for bringing us home cooked food and things, because you can't even lift the teacup basically when you come out from surgery like that. And Andrew was, you know, still working every day, so my girls all kind of rolled their sleeves up and brought beautiful food. Probably for about a month or so they took care of us like that. As a friend came and helped me clean the house, which is fantastic. She wouldn't take any money for it. You know, so I think I am profoundly blessed by the relationships that I've got. I'd like to think that's a bit of karma as well. I like to think if you put in, you get something back, you know, and I couldn't get through it without them. I have my moments, like I have just done and had a little weep. You know, I have my moments when I get like that, and other times I'm quite sanguine about it, but it's just one hell of a journey.
And you're incredibly passionate, as you say, you post a lot on social media about it, getting that message out there. There's been some fundraising as well.
Absolutely. So an old school friend of my daughter, who's Sophie Van Hooven Christian, she did the parish walk and raised about $4,500 for a very special charity called Overcome, who are very, very supportive of people who've been newly diagnosed, and the families have sort of created a proper community. And Overcome is amazing, and again, I'm sure you'll put some links out for Overcome. They do some fantastic reading material. The website's absolutely brilliant. So, you know, if you were unlucky to get a diagnosis, or someone you love has a diagnosis, or you just want to know more about it, then Overcome is a great place to start. Various family members have also raised funds, you know, through walks and through this. I mean, I think Sophie raised about four and a half thousand pounds, and I think we've raised another couple of thousand pounds, I would say. So now that becomes really important, because Overcome does things like gentle yoga over Zoom, and, you know, they do meet and greets. You know, when you live here, you know, when you're away from, it's not like you're at the Christie in Manchester where you would have lots of people who are in the same boat as you. They do those kinds of almost social gatherings, and they were doing a sort of like sing with Overcome, you know, that there's people on Zoom, and they would have almost like a virtual choir, and, you know, just really nice things like that. But they need funds, you know, in order to do that. So yeah, great to do that. And there's another charity which is called Target Ovarian Cancer, who is more about research, more about the clinical stuff, but they need funds too. So yeah, the more I can bang the drum, the more people are aware, might save a few people, and they might raise some money, and then my work here is done.
Sarah, it's been an absolute privilege talking to you. Enjoy Simple Minds at the weekend.
Thank you. Sarah, I know it does give my age away, but like fabulous nonetheless.
It's all right, you said it at the beginning anyway. Sarah Jarvis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Little Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.